This is World Editor-in-Chief Marvin Olasky. Thanks for being a World member. You make our work possible, and we appreciate your support.
Good morning. Today is Thursday, June 23rd, 2016, and you're listening to The World and Everything in It from member-supported World Radio. I'm Kent Covington. And I'm Joseph Slive, ahead today the GOP convention delegate who's spearheading the Dump Trump movement.
In a constitutional republic, you are never directly voting for the candidate. For a nominating convention, you are voting for a delegate to cast your ballot on your behalf. Those are people with a conscience, and our founding fathers wanted it that way as a check and balance in the system.
Plus, World's Book of the Year in the fiction category. First, Nick Eicher has a summary of today's top news.
Drama all day on Capitol Hill in Washington yesterday as House Democrats stage a sit-in.
We will occupy this floor.
An occupation that shut down House business in the morning.
We sit down.
Gentlemen's time has expired. Pursuant to Clause 12, Paren A of Rule 1, Chair declares the House in recess till the hour of 12 noon.
About 40 Democrats sat cross-legged in the well of the House and refused to leave, some of them chanting gun control slogans. They demand House Speaker Paul Ryan allow votes on bills that would outlaw gun purchases by those placed on certain government watch lists and expand background checks. With the House shut down and cameras shut off, Democrats broadcast on social media using their smartphones. Republicans tried gaveling back in at noon.
The House will be in order.
Quieting their protesting colleagues just long enough for a prayer from the chaplain.
The House will be in order. The chair wishes to entertain the prayer by the chaplain.
And for a Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Then it was back to disruption and chants of no bill, no break. House Democrats meaning by that to block summer recess until Republicans give in. Then, not even 3 minutes after gaveling in, the presiding officer, Texas Republican Ted Poe, gaveled out.
The chair finds that the House is currently not in a state of order due to the presence of members in the well who are not recognized. The House stands in recess subject to the call of the chair.
The next call of the chair came around 10 p.m. It was Paul Ryan himself.
The chair appreciates that members will differ on matters of policy and will seek to express those differences. But the chair would hope that the business of the House could be conducted in a fashion that respects positively on the dignity and the decorum of this institution to which we all belong.
Ryan held two procedural votes, and about a half hour later, the House adjourned again and the Democratic protest resumed. Earlier in the day, over on the Senate side, Republican Susan Collins of Maine led an effort to hammer out a bipartisan gun bill.
Surely the terrorist attacks in San Bernardino and in Orlando that took so many lives are a call for compromise, a plea for bipartisan action.
Collins's measure would bar gun sales to people on the no-fly list and those on the selectee list. That is to say, those selected to board a flight only after an intensive screening. Together, those two lists contain the names of more than 100,000. South Carolina Republican Lindsey Graham supports the measure, despite opposition from the National Rifle Association and despite concerns about Second Amendment rights.
But every right has boundaries to it. I think we're at war. I think this is an accommodation that needs to be made because our nation is under threat.
The measure would allow Americans who are denied guns to appeal in federal court. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell agreed to allow the vote on the bill, but he did not endorse it. A key Senate Republican who'd intended to leave after one term is officially now seeking a second term. World Radio's Christina Darnell on Marco Rubio's change of heart.
The junior senator from Florida and former presidential candidate had promised not to run for the Senate again if he failed to get the GOP bid for the White House. But Marco Rubio now says America needs every conservative it can get in the Senate.
No matter who wins this presidential election, the Senate's role of being able to act as a check and balance on bad ideas from the president, I think, are going to matter more in 2017 than they perhaps ever have in our history. And that's
And Rubio brushed off talk that his decision to run again for the Senate is just a prelude to another presidential bid.
If I wanted to run for president in 2020, running for re-election in this environment with a real risk of losing is a tough race. It's probably not the ideal political decision to make.
I'm Christina Darnell.
The morning after Hillary Clinton tagged Donald Trump dangerous, Trump returned the volley of adjectives.
Hillary Clinton may be the most corrupt person ever to seek the presidency of the United States.
Trump traded his off-the-cuff style for a formal speech from a teleprompter. Speaking in New York City, Trump critiqued Clinton's record as Secretary of State. He suggested that her approval of selling 20% of America's uranium to Russia was a corrupt deal.
Nine investors in the deal funneled $145 million to the Clinton Foundation.
And Trump suggested that Clinton supports Muslim immigration because she takes money from Islamic heads of state.
Hillary Clinton accepted $58,000 in jewelry from the government of Brunei, plus millions more for her foundation. The Sultan of Brunei has pushed punishment by death if you happen to be gay.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Great.
Hi. Hey.
Meantime, Clinton huddled with House Democrats. California's Javier Becerra came out of the meeting with the presumptive Democratic nominee with a challenge for Trump.
The moment that Donald Trump reveals his tax returns, which every candidate for president has done for decades, then maybe we'll listen to what Donald Trump has to say. But until then, Donald Trump is hiding something.
Clinton addressed supporters later in the day in North Carolina. She said Trump's accusations were a substitute for substance. Lost amid the Democratic sit-in shutting down business on Capitol Hill, House Republicans yesterday finally rolled out their plan to replace Obamacare. The central feature, doing away with the unpopular individual mandate, House Speaker Paul Ryan.
Instead of forcing you to buy a plan that Washington bureaucrats have mass-produced, we're going to repeal those mandates and let you pick a plan that works for you, for your family.
The Republican alternative would require insurance companies to compete across state lines and allow small businesses to join together to provide cheaper coverage to all their employees. It does keep some aspects of Obamacare that are more politically palatable. It would retain the guarantee of coverage for pre-existing conditions, and it would allow adults to stay on their parents' plans until they turn 26. Ryan conceded the Obamacare replacement has no chance unless the GOP captures the White House. I'm Nick Eicher. Up next, the woman behind a movement among Republican Party delegates to stop Donald Trump in Cleveland. Plus, World's Book of the Year for Fiction, a present-day retelling of Shakespeare's Taming of the Shrew. This is The World and Everything in It.
Every day we're bombarded with information ranging from misleading to meaningless. But World's reliable reporting brings clarity to the news, helping your family make sense of the madness. We can't stop the barrage of messages targeted at our families, but we can help you be the strongest voice in the room with our new family membership, equipping your entire family with truth and biblical perspective. Redeem your family membership today at wng.org/family.
You're listening to The World and Everything in It. I'm Kent Covington. With the Republican National Convention in Cleveland now less than a month away, the GOP is anything but unified. Its presumptive presidential nominee, Donald Trump, enjoys wildly enthusiastic support among his backers, but that support comes from less than half of Republican primary voters, and many of the remaining voters are just as passionately opposed to Trump. And now there is a growing movement among Republican delegates to derail the Trump train in Cleveland. That effort is called Free the Delegates, and it's spearheaded by Kendall Unruh, a Ted Cruz delegate from Colorado, and she joins us now via telephone. And Kendall, I've heard a lot of folks in the Trump camp say, you know, first of all, they've dismissed the effort. They say it has no chance of succeeding. But they also say that it's being driven by the party establishment or by the Washington elite. Do you fit that description?
Well, let's see. If elite is defined as someone who has spent her entire adult life working within a grassroots movement to bring other grassroots activists on board, but that's not the definition of elite. By profession, I'm a high school American government teacher, and I teach juniors at a private Christian school, and that is my passion. As a hobby, I have dabbled in politics and have tried to advance godly principles into the political arena by recruiting and training and working to get elected people of faith that share a godly platform. And part of my activity has centered around running slates for the national conventions, because those delegates are the ones who vote on the platform, and those delegates are also at a local level who elect the platform committee members and the rule committee members.
Yes, so let me ask you about that. You are one of 112 delegates on the RNC Rules Committee.
Correct.
Who will decide how the nomination process works in Cleveland. So tell us a little bit more about the Free the Delegates movement and what you're trying to accomplish. Obviously, it's an effort to stop Donald Trump from winning the nomination on the first ballot at the convention, but he does have several hundred more pledged delegates than needed. So how exactly would that work?
Well, legally, the delegates are unbound. 39 of 40 conventions, the delegates have always been unbound and free to vote their conscience. There was only one time in the history of the Republican Party that they were locked in to vote as a unit, and that was in 1976 when Ford ran against Ronald Reagan, and Ford pushed out what was called the Justice Amendment. So it literally shut down the ability for a delegate to be unbound and vote their conscience. So what I'm doing is I'm sponsoring a conscience clause, which in essence is the memo to the delegates to activate the power, the kryptonite that they already have to unbind, because they don't realize that they don't have to be a robot. And what the conscience clause allows for is either a personal or religious exemption to casting that first ballot, that there will not be any party retribution, that the secretary has to record it as cast, and that they may cite any reason, whether it is religious, which is what I'm going to cite, and there are others such as criminal activity, not adhering to the platform, moral turpitude, or grievous acts of prejudice and racism. And they are not locked in by state primary outcomes.
All right. And how is this effort progressing? How much momentum have you gathered to this point?
Well, it started out with just a handful of people, and then we all read Curly Hoglund's Unbound book, which should be required reading for all the delegates. And it opened our eyes to the fact that constitutionally, even in light of state primaries, we are not bound. And we went from a handful of 9 to 30 to 1,000, and now next week it's going to be 5,000 activists and supporters that want to help drive the issue. Let me explain why that's important. We have 400 delegates, and we have several platform committee members, several credentialing committee members, and about 17 rules committee members. So we tapped into the 60% that did not want Trump. We have, you know, 7 out of 10 won't vote for him. Well, we've tapped into those 7 out of 10, and we need a lobbying effort. It's not just enough to have us working it. We need pressure from the outside. So we have people that are contacting the rules committee members and,
gotcha,
and their delegates on the floor to inform them that they need to unbind.
Now, of the delegates that have signed on, how many of those are would-be Trump delegates?
Yeah, you know, that's an interesting question. I don't know the breakdown on who is soft Trump. But what is happening is you're getting this incredible pushback from Trump supporters who are in party positions, your state chairs, your RNC committee people, et cetera. And so when these delegates are letting it be known that they're going to unbind, then they're being threatened with party sanctions up to $10,000, banishment from the party for 10 years, various threats and coercion, which doesn't bode well for a presidential candidate when those are the only tactics that he can employ in order to get a vote out of a delegate. And right to conscience is something that is so inherent in an individual. The fact that our very nation was founded on free conscience, and the fact that the founding fathers and the pilgrims, well, the pilgrims came here because of free conscience, and the founding fathers developed a Bill of Rights because of free conscience. And you can't force a doctor to do an abortion because of free conscience. You can't make a county clerk. Well, you get the point.
Right. Kendall, I do have to ask here, as you know, the major objection to this, even among people who don't support Trump, their objection to this effort is that it will thwart the will of the voters, that he won it fair and square, and that they to take it away from him now would be the wrong thing to do. And I think this is at least a valid question to ask. You know, if all of the delegates are free to support whichever candidate they want for a long list of reasons, then what's the point of ever voting in a primary?
Right. And now the government teacher is going to come out. We're not a democracy. We're a constitutional republic. And our founding fathers were very clear. They did not want a democracy because they called it mobocracy, mob rule. They knew that human nature, because it was sinful, tended to fall to the lowest common denominator. And they had seen in history where democracies turn into chaos and disorder and anarchy. So they that is why they developed the Constitutional Republic, and that is a check and balance system. And in a Constitutional Republic with the checks and balances, you are never directly voting for the candidate. In this kind of an issue for a nominating convention, you are voting directly for a delegate. In the general election, you are voting for an elector to cast your ballot on your behalf. But those are people with a conscience that are casting a vote. And our founding fathers implicitly wanted it that way as a check and balance in the system. Even if it was a numbers game, let's just even say I played that game of majority rules, and if I can get 50-1, I win. Which I didn't buy into that, but let's hypothetically say that I do for a moment. We are still representing 60% of the people in the primaries that did not vote for Donald Trump. And 7 out of 10 of the Republicans that are not supporting Donald Trump. So, but in the primaries, you have blanket and open primaries that allowed same-day voter registration. So you had people that were not Republicans that were coming out and voting, and that is who gave us our nominee. It is now our job as a party to decide to rubber stamp that nominee or not. And not only are we allowed to do it by law, but even ethically, it's imperative that we do it. The other thing is, I am accountable to the thousands of voters that voted for me. I answer to them. It's like being in Congress. If they do something that we don't like, we hold them accountable. I'm not accountable to the party, and I'm not accountable to the RNC. So it's their voices I listen to. It's them that I'm going to have to answer to.
Okay. Kendall Unruh, thank you very much for your time and for joining us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Honest journalism is biblical journalism. We believe good reporting must begin with a proper understanding of the world, of human nature, and of God's role in our lives. World stories are insightful, reliable, and real, the result of straightforward reporting from an independent nonprofit organization with 30 years of credibility. It's reporting that's harder and harder to find. It's reporting worth supporting. WNG.org/worldmovers.
Thank you for being with us today for The World and Everything in It from World Radio. Up next, the second in our series on World's Books of the Year.
Each summer, our sister publication, World Magazine, highlights the best books published over the past 12 months and names its Books of the Year in various categories. Last week, we highlighted the Book of the Year in the Current Events category. Today, we turn to the Fiction category. And our Susan Olasky is here to tell us about the winning novel this year. Hi, Susan.
Hey, Joseph.
Now, this book is titled Vinegar Girl. It's by well-known novelist Ann Tyler. She's a Pulitzer Prize winner for a previous novel. And Susan, this one has been published as part of something called the Hogarth Shakespeare series. Tell our listeners what William Shakespeare has to do with this 2016 novel.
Well, it's an updating and retelling of Shakespeare's play, The Taming of the Shrew.
All right, so this is a boy meets girl story, but as in Shakespeare's play, the girl definitely is not a shrinking violet. Let's listen to a snippet from the audiobook edition of Vinegar Girl. This is the first meeting between the boy and the girl at the office of the girl's father, a university research scientist.
Ah, Kate, he said. Come in. No thanks, she said. Your lunch is on the table. Bye. No, wait. He turned from her to speak to someone in the room behind him. Pyotr, come out and say hello to my daughter. I've got to go, Kate said. I don't think you've ever met my research assistant, her father said. That's okay. But the door opened wider, and a solid, muscular man with straight yellow hair stepped up to stand next to her father. His white lab coat was so dingy that it very nearly matched Dr. Batista's pale gray coveralls. Vwalv, he said. Or that was what it sounded like, at least. He was gazing at Kate admiringly. This is Pyotr Cherbakov, her father told her. Pyotr, the man corrected him, allowing no space at all between the sharp-pointed T and the ruffly rolling R. And Cherbakov, explosively spitting out the mishmash of consonants. Pyotr, meet Kate. Hi, Kate said. See you later, she told her father. I thought you might stay a moment. What for? Well, you'll need to take back my sandwich box, will you not? Well, you can bring it back yourself, can you not? A sudden hooting sound made both of them glance in Pyotr's direction. Just like the girls in my country, he said, beaming. So rude-spoken. Just like the women, Kate said reprovingly. Yes, they also, the grandmothers and the aunties. She gave up on him.
Now, as in the Shakespeare play, the young man is quickly smitten with the young woman. She just kind of ignores him. But, of course, the plot is going to thicken. Now, Susan, I'm sure there's a challenge here in presenting a present-day version of this story, The Taming of the Shrew. In Shakespeare, of course, the strong-willed Kate learns happiness ultimately by giving way to the will of her suitor, Petruchio. Now, without giving away too much of this story, how does the author here, Ann Tyler, make that kind of turn of events acceptable to many modern readers?
Well, first, let me just clarify that even if you don't know Shakespeare, the book stands on its own. You don't have to have ever read The Taming of the Shrew. But back to your question. In Shakespeare, there's sort of a humiliating ending where Petruchio really subdues Kate. That doesn't happen here. Here, Pyotr woos Kate, maybe, by appreciating her. He sees something in her that was dormant, neither she nor her father had seen. And so it's really a little bit of a flip on the pretty politically incorrect.
All right. Well, let's listen to one more clip from the audiobook version of Vinegar Girl. The young man, Pyotr, just happens to bump into Kate as she's walking somewhere.
Behind her, she heard her name called. She turned to see a light-haired man hurrying toward her with one arm raised, as if he were hailing a cab. For a moment, she couldn't imagine what he had to do with her, but then she recognized her father's research assistant. The absence of his lab coat had confused her. He was wearing jeans and a plain gray jersey. "Hi," he said as he arrived next to her. "Pyotr," she said. "Pyotr." "How are you doing?" she said. "I fear I may be having cold," he told her. "My nose waters and I sneeze a great deal. Has been taking place since last night." "Bummer," she said. She resumed walking, and he fell into step alongside her. "It was a good day at your school?" he asked. "It was okay." "Shouldn't you be at work?" she asked him. "Yes, I am just going." Since the lab lay two blocks in the opposite direction, this didn't make any sense, but that was no concern of hers. "In my country, we have proverb," Pyotr was saying. Didn't they always, Kate thought. "We say, work when it is divided into segments is shorter total period of time than work when it is all together in one unit." "Catchy," Kate said. "How long have you been letting your hair grow?" The change of subject took her aback. "What?" she said. "Oh, since eighth grade, maybe? I don't know. I just couldn't take any more of that Chatty Cathy act." "Chatty Cathy?" "In the beauty parlor. Talk, talk, talk. Those places are crawling with talk. The women there start going before they even sit down. Talk about boyfriends, husbands, mothers-in-law, roommates, jealous girlfriends, feuds and misunderstandings and romances and divorces. How can they find so much to say? I could never think of anything myself. I kept disappointing my beautician. Finally, I went, I'll just quit getting my hair cut." "It is exceedingly attractive," Pyotr said. "Thanks," Kate said. "Well, this is where I turn off. Do you realize the lab's back that way?" "Oh, it's back that way," Pyotr said. He didn't seem too perturbed about it. "Okay, Kate, see you soon. Was nice having a talk." Kate had already started down her own street, and she raised an arm without looking back.
Now, Susan Olasky, here's the question you knew I was going to ask you. Why was Vinegar Girl chosen as World's Fiction Book of the Year?
In the first place, it's funny. It's perceptive about human nature, and it has a really great last chapter. But the real reason we chose it was its ringing affirmation of marriage and its understanding that marriage can actually help both husband and wife blossom. Marriage doesn't have to be constricting. And literally in this book, marriage makes Kate and Pyotr both more fruitful. So sort of a countercultural message.
Again, our book of the year in the fiction category is Vinegar Girl by Ann Tyler. You can read more about it in World's annual books issue. That's the current June 25th issue of World Magazine. We have two more categories to showcase, history and accessible theology. And we'll be highlighting the books of the year in those categories in days to come.
Children today are hit with more media messages than you parents could have possibly imagined just 10 years ago when I was born. Frankly, we need a context for those messages so that as we grow up, it'll be a lot easier to recognize what's true and what's not. World Kids can help by providing a safe pathway for kids to explore God's creation and make sense of the world with each passing day and year. You can learn more at wng.org/children.
Thanks for listening to The World and Everything in It from World Radio. American voters appear to be on the verge of nominating two major party presidential candidates who polls suggest most voters don't believe to be honest or trustworthy. And commentator Cal Thomas wonders what that says about America today.
Ranking right up there with a line, "Other than that, Mrs. Lincoln, how'd you like the play?" is this recent headline in the Washington Times. Honesty issues aside, voters still back Hillary Clinton, poll shows. Though Clinton's negatives appear higher than that of any Democrat running for president in perhaps all of history, and Donald Trump's are even higher, honesty appears not to matter in this election, especially to younger voters. The Washington Times story is based on a poll taken by the technology company Morning Consult, which found that Hillary Clinton's 56% unfavorability rating is driven by the fact that 39% of Democrats and 47% of independents say she can't be trusted, and that many of those who view her unfavorably also say she's flat-out corrupt. Trump doesn't fare much better. A recent Gallup poll found just 33% say Trump is honest and trustworthy, a mere 1% higher than Hillary Clinton. With such numbers, Trump's label of crooked Hillary doesn't have the moral impact it might have if more people thought he was a man of good character. Has the state of our politics sunk so low that voters no longer expect honesty, integrity, and character to be factors in deciding for whom to vote? How can this be? Isn't a person's trustworthiness essential when we decide to buy a house or car, conclude a business deal, or get married? If character matters in these and other circumstances, why does it matter less in selecting our next president? And if character doesn't matter, won't that almost ensure we will get more people running for and serving in office who have less and less of it? Brandon Rottinghouse is a political science professor at the University of Houston. In the Times story, he's quoted as saying, quote, "Trustworthiness by itself is less important than trustworthiness to handle specific issues like national security or the economy. In the context of the 2016 election, Clinton's low trust numbers may not mean much. If she is matched against a different nominee of the opposing party, she might be in danger. Trump's bucolic approach to politics gives her some much-needed cover," unquote. But doesn't it all go together? If one is dishonest in one's private dealings, that must spill over into one's public life, right? Take the Clintons as Exhibit A. Sometimes one finds a quote from an unexpected source that summarizes an issue. The actor and martial arts expert Bruce Lee once said, "Knowledge will give you power, but character, respect." In this election, two people are seeking power, but it looks like whichever one wins will have a long way to go toward gaining respect. Voters have become so angry and cynical about the state of our government and its leaders, they no longer expect to respect them. If that is where we are, does that not say more about us than it does about them? For World Radio, I'm Cal Thomas.
Cal Thomas is one of America's most popular syndicated newspaper columnists. He writes for USA Today, appears frequently on Fox News, and he provides commentary twice a week for World Radio. That is our program for this Thursday, the 23rd of June. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio, part of World, a nonprofit news team committed to honest reporting from a biblical worldview perspective. Thanks for being a World member. You make this program possible. We'd appreciate it if you'd tell your friends about our complimentary 3-month trial membership. It'll give them full access to this program, along with the World website and World in print, all at no charge. Tell them to go to getworldnow.com. Getworldnow.com. I'm Kent Covington.
And I'm Joseph Slive. On tomorrow's program, Trevin Wax is in for John Stone Street for a conversation on the culture. Plus, World's Megan Basham on the new Disney Pixar film, Finding Dory. We hope you can join us for the world and everything in it.